Hello and welcome to this debate reaction edition of the 538 Politics podcast. I'm Galen Druk. It was a big debate, literally. There were 12 people on stage and it lasted 3 hours. It also forced the three polling leaders to confront important developments in their campaigns. Warren defending her newly minted position as frontrunner, Biden responding to Trump's attacks on Ukraine, and Sanders addressing his health post-heart attack. So how did it all play out, and did anyone outside of that top three-tier break through? Here with me to discuss are Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver.
Hey, Galen.
Hi, enjoy that debate.
I thought it was an interesting debate. Also, congratulations to the Washington Nationals on being nationally representative in the World Series.
And also here with us is Managing Editor Micah Cohen. How are you?
Hello.
And joining us remotely is Senior Politics Writer Claire Malone. How's it going?
Yo.
Hey.
Good.
Good. All right. So can we start off by going through, maybe quickly, those three main developments facing the top three candidates? So Elizabeth Warren, this was her first debate as arguably the front runner or maybe co-front runner. How did that pan out for her?
It was very different for Warren being a frontrunner. She got far more talk time than anyone else. She took a lot of incoming fire, including from candidates such as Mayor Pete and Klobuchar, who had been relatively congenial and kind of meek in previous debates. And I think it's a difficult dynamic to evaluate. I know it's a cop-out. I kind of want to see what polls say about it, about her performance. You know, kind of I thought that her answers on healthcare actually do seem a bit evasive and not that great. I thought she mostly held up fairly well. Otherwise, I think sometimes if voters merely see that you're the center of attention, it kind of sends a subliminal message to voters that, hey, maybe you are the front runner. And remember, a lot of Democrats come in liking Warren in the first place. In our polling with Ipsos, she had, I believe, the highest net favorability rating. I think Biden may have had higher favorable, but she had the lowest unfavorable rating, I believe, and the best net. And so Democrats are going to come in kind of wanting to think the debate went well for Warren. And so if it was kind of ambiguous, then it might kind of come out fine for her. At the end of the day, if you're one of the front runners and you don't totally screw up, then that usually winds up okay, an okay proposition for you.
All right, Claire, what did you make of how Warren handled her first debate as that front runner?
Well, you know, I think it was certainly a different dynamic for her. I think she suffered in some ways from having a couple of people attacking her. And, you know, the moderators will let you kind of answer if your name has been mentioned in someone's statement. But, you know, she was being mentioned so much that she sort of, by virtue of the number of responses being lobbed at her, didn't really get to respond to everyone. I think Warren being at the center stage was actually in some ways a good thing for Biden. You know, he was one person who, looking at the end of the night, I thought, well, he didn't get as much speaking time, but he also didn't have as much time to mess up or say something kind of blundery. And yes, he had to address some of the Ukraine stuff, but in some ways, yes, Biden wasn't treated as the front runner by the other candidates or even in some instances, the moderators. But Warren kind of, you know, she was taking incoming fire, to use the overused metaphor. And Biden was just kind of like probably not gaining any supporters, but not hurting himself. So yeah, it was kind of hard for me to tell.
I have the same general thoughts that Nate and Claire do, and the same instinct that, like, I kind of want to just wait to see what the polls say. You know, I'm always impressed by Warren in these debates. She's just really quick on her feet rhetorically. There was just this one moment, for instance, where Buttigieg sort of attacks her explicitly or implicitly, I can't really remember, as, like, always wanting to fight. And right away, Warren turns that to, well, you know, people struggling to pay healthcare are fighting, right? And she just, like, rhetorically in the debate, she's just really good on those grounds.
She also had that moment in the exchange with Biden toward the end where Biden, in a way that I think was Biden's worst moment in the debate, was like, you know, I kind of did that for you, which I think is kind of patronizing.
Right.
And you know, frankly, I think kind of verges into kind of a little gendered or sexist territory. But she kind of pointedly said, well, I appreciated President Obama's,
yeah,
right? But then she didn't quite twist the knife, and that showed, like, a lot of discretion or restraint. Yeah, and I think that showed a certain maturity, right? And she didn't, like, get into pointless fights, right? So, for example, when Harris, if you follow my Twitter feed, you know that I think the notion that the president of the United States can be deplatformed from Twitter is a stupid idea. Sorry, Kamala Harris. But I also thought she showed good restraint there in, like, saying, this is such a stupid idea. She didn't say that, but, like, I'm not going to even, like,
she didn't
I'm just going to wave my hand and say, yeah. No, you're looking stupid. Go ahead and waste one of the few moments you get to actually say anything, Kamala Harris, in this exchange. So, like, so she's kind of playing a long game. You know, clearly there was nothing that happened to Elizabeth Warren that will greatly injure her chances.
I overall agree with that, probably, right? And like you guys, I want to see the poll numbers. But I have been thinking a lot about how Warren plays in the general election, right? Like, and that's not a, you know, a lot of people can kind of say, like, well, is the electability argument about gender or race? And like, yes, it is the straight up answer. But also I'm curious about Warren's policy ideas on healthcare and how they play with voters. And the one place where I think potentially she could have made some people, could have given some voters a second thought, particularly frankly in states like Ohio or Wisconsin or Michigan, where people, even Democrats, are kind of thinking about voting strategically, even if they agree with Warren. And I wonder if the sharp attacks by Buttigieg and Klobuchar in particular could stick with Warren. Buttigieg is another person. I'm not sure how his performance will have played with voters. You know, Castro was nicked in the polls when he went after Biden, but Biden was a well-liked candidate by a lot of voters. And, you know, I think, you know, Buttigieg went after O'Rourke. O'Rourke isn't very popular, but Buttigieg went after Warren too. And I'm not quite sure how that all plays out. I do have a sense that voters are concerned in some ways about her left positions on healthcare and whether or not they will freak people out.
To that point, Claire, the other campaigns seem clearly convinced they are trying to get Warren to say, I'm going to have to raise taxes on the middle class to get to pay for my health care plan. Warren refuses to say it, right? The other campaigns are clearly convinced that's a vulnerability for her. They keep bringing it up. They brought it up in previous debates. They really went after her in this debate for it. I guess I'm just not sure that voters are really going to like that voters paying that close attention. And like, you know, maybe it'll be a general election liability, as Claire said, but I don't know.
Well, wasn't it a real vulnerability for Kamala Harris, for example, in the second debate where before which she released her health care plan that was kind of somewhere in between the, you know, Sanders Medicare for All and the Biden let's double down on Obamacare. And it made her kind of look silly and unable to like pin down her position.
I don't think we know. I think maybe that had a role in Harris's decline. But one, Warren's just been a lot more adept at responding to it. And she's been a lot more adept at not answering.
Which is, just, yeah, I mean, it's just boldly not answering.
Yeah, but that's politics, right? It's like you try to maintain these vague stances.
I mean, I feel like we're overlooking one important dynamic, which frankly didn't necessarily occur at the debate itself, but is more occurring in the background. Which is tonight, there
Here
are reports that Bernie Sanders will be endorsed by AOC and two other members of the squad.
Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar.
And if you kind of follow some comments that Bernie has made, and Bernie has been kind of gentle and gracious in these comments. It hasn't been like super vicious or anything. But also if you kind of read like a lot of the debate on the online left, you have seen rapid escalations of Warren versus Sanders tensions. You have seen them go after one another. There is no longer a ceasefire, so to speak, after Sanders' heart attack. And I think having these quite prominent and fairly popular, but quite vocally anti-establishment Democrats get behind Bernie is going to kind of further blow up the anti-establishment slash left nexus of like Bernie versus Warren conflict. And so kind of one question for Warren is, could she get squeezed by, on the one hand, Bernie having a little bit of a revitalization on the left, and then on the other side of it, people in the moderate lane are a little too concerned about is she too far to left anyway? Maybe if Buttigieg or Klobuchar rise, they're starting to kind of peel off a few voters who drifted from Biden to Warren, although there aren't that many of those. I don't know. But, like, I do think this kind of question of, do the voters who are currently committed to Warren, are they dug in? Because if they're dug in, then she doesn't have much to worry about. She has to beat Biden or some candidate who surges, right? If they're not dug in, and if Bernie can claw back, I thought he had a good night, a few percentage points on the left, then that becomes more interesting. And she has to decide sort of whether, hey, am I going to fight for those voters on the left or kind of concede them? Because there's some advantages to her saying, you know what? Okay, a lot of general election voters don't like the squad. I will let the squad endorse Bernie and kind of subliminally or not so subliminally kind of send the message to voters that, like, he is the one who the anti-establishment crazy, quote unquote, Democrats like. And I'm the one who normal liberal Democrats like. And I think, yeah, you know, it's really interesting dynamic. And I think maybe more interesting than. Yeah.
Claire, you've been tracking, like, left politics over the past few years. What do you make of the endorsements?
To be honest, I was a little surprised by AOC's endorsement, if only because it seemed like there was a lot of there is a lot of momentum by Warren in the polls. It seems like, you know, AOC is willing to work with Pelosi, is willing to play nice with more establishment Democrats. You know, Warren is a woman. I thought maybe that might be tilting her in her favor. So it's interesting to me that she is supporting Sanders, although obviously not totally out of the realm of the expected. I think it's interesting that Ayanna Pressley hasn't come out yet and endorsed. I mean, maybe she will. Who knows? Obviously, she and Warren are from the same state. You know, who knows if she's going to come out and endorse Warren in the next couple days? Who knows if Bernie's going to come out and she's going to come out and endorse Bernie? Who knows? There is, though, I think, some sense from people who are, I think basically there's like a class split in some ways between people who on the left who have remained more hardcore Bernie. And I tend to boil it down to, like, Warren has gotten a lot of those Clinton voters, those more maybe college educated, well off Democratic voters who supported Clinton in the primary, but perhaps have some, you know, buyer's regret or say, yikes, I didn't like Bernie, but maybe he was doing something right. And I think, like, AOC and Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib really pride themselves on having working class roots, right, and representing those communities. And Bernie Sanders, I think, still does in many ways speak more viscerally to those communities than, say, Elizabeth Warren, you know, no matter Warren's own background of being pretty working class. So there's just sort of this interesting class alignment, frankly, within the left that I think perhaps we're seeing with these three women endorsing Sanders.
We have a lot to talk about in this debate recap, and maybe the topic of these endorsements will come up again when we talk about Sanders. But let's move on to Biden for right now. Biden had to address the issue of President Trump attacking him on Ukraine, his son Hunter Biden suggesting that, you know, the role he played was inappropriate. So what was Biden's tact going in? I mean, it wasn't a big topic during the debate, but how did he address that?
I thought for such a predictable question, his answer was somewhat garbled, but it basically came down to, listen, that's not the real issue. The issue is Trump. But I tend not to think actually he'll have much of an issue with this in the Democratic primary. I think almost all voters will be predisposed to view it the way Biden laid it out, which is like the real question isn't about what my son did, it's about what Trump did. But still, I just thought I would actually put Biden's sort of non-polished responses to a lot of these questions in the same bucket as Warren's refusal to sort of give specifics on her plan to pay for healthcare, in that a lot of people, like, every time I see Biden give one of those rambling answers, I think, oh, that's not going to play well. But it hasn't really hurt. I don't think it's hurt him much so far. I don't know. Maybe it has. So it's sort of just like a wait and see approach.
Yeah. And I think you have to adjust a little bit if you're kind of following the debate online on Twitter, right, as we do, that, like, Democrats on Twitter are not the biggest Joe Biden fans. I have to break it to people. You know, it's like a lot. I felt like we've had, like, a lot of these Biden debates, with the exception of the first one where he was, like, I think, quite bad. Even then, that badness was concentrated later on in the debate, right? There's kind of this thing of, like, oh, Biden, actually, he's holding up pretty well, and then he has some moment toward the end. You know, was it last week? It was about like phonographs or record players, right? This time, I think the kind of final exchange with Sanders and Warren. But this time, I think it kind of came, the negative parts came furthest into the debate and were the least obviously bad. Like, my intuition is like we said earlier, like, I don't think that exchange with Warren will play that great, but I don't know. And remember, you know, the lowest hanging fruit is just got to hang on to like the 28% of voters that like him now, right?
Right.
Obviously, in the long run, you have to win some percentage of the 72% who don't have you as, don't have him as their first choice right now. But I don't know. I mean, I think given that, like, he knew the questions were coming on Trump and Ukraine, I thought he could have been a bit more forceful. I thought he was mostly pretty good on the foreign policy sections. You know, I think it helped him not to be having these long exchanges and stuff like that.
But let's dive into the Biden Warren moment, because not only was that a striking moment where Biden was like kind of yelling at Warren saying, "I got you votes."
And this was on the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau issue.
Yeah, I thought that was one of several moments where Biden, I would almost guess that one of the Biden campaign strategies going into tonight was, hey, look for a couple moments to be really, really forceful. I don't know what that was in response to. Maybe it was about questions about age, but Biden did it in his, I think it was his closing statement.
Get up.
Yeah, where he was like, you know, he was like almost yelling. But anyway, I don't know about that strategy in general or the
or the
Warren exchange in particular. Claire, did you thought that was an odd exchange, right?
I didn't think it was odd so much as a almost naked display of their dislike for each other. Warren and Biden have known each other for a very long time and have always been within the Democratic Party kind of ideologically opposed to each other. And I think throw into that the fact that he was kind of trying to get in, you know, his whole like master of the Senate thing. You know, I went in there and got votes for you. And she was trying to say, thanks, Obama. No, thanks, Biden. And I think that, you know, we talked earlier about, or Mike, I think, said earlier that she was very disciplined in that moment. And she certainly was. I think disciplined is the correct word. You know, I think there were several, I hesitate to say it was gendered because I think condescension can often just play as like condescension and nothing more. But there were a couple times when I would say the moderates went after Warren, and coming from Biden and Buttigieg, a couple of the moments were a little bit, you could categorize them as, you know, withering to the point of awkwardness, you know, to watch it unfold. But Warren is disciplined in her response and sort of wanted to say the right thing, which is, I like Obama. I will not cede my ground that Joe Biden made my baby of an agency happen. Yeah, you could just kind of see it was a little bit of like a cold smolder on her part.
This debate, more than any debate we've had so far, I feel least confident in my appraisal of sort of how voters will react to it. Maybe the safest assumption is they won't react at all.
I mean, that's been a safe assumption so far, more or less.
It's interesting that several of the candidates sort of said, we've had this discussion time and again, right? And you almost felt like they were sort of speaking to the voters saying like, yes, we understand that you're irritated that we're having the same discussions for 3 hours in front of you again and again. And it mostly seemed to come over their fight about healthcare. And you saw Cory Booker trying to be the, geez, guys, this doesn't look good that we're fighting amongst each other. Can't we all be a little nicer? There was a certain like hamster wheel quality to all of it. Where, you know, 4 hours after the start time or whatever time it is, we're all kind of like, well.
For us, though, right? We're not consuming all of this, though, like most people, right? We've watched every minute of every debate and yeah.
All right. So let's move on and talk next about how Sanders responded to questions about his age post-heart attack. And then we're going to get into some other broader questions. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hiring can be a slow process. Here's an example. Cafe Altura's COO, Dylan Miskowitz, needed to hire a director of coffee for his organic coffee company, but he was having trouble finding qualified applicants. So he switched to ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job, so you get qualified candidates fast. Dylan posted his job on ZipRecruiter and said he was impressed by how quickly he got candidates to apply. He also used ZipRecruiter's candidate rating feature to filter his applicants so he could focus on the most relevant ones. And that's how Dylan found his new director of coffee in just a few days. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at this web address, ZipRecruiter.com/538. That's ZipRecruiter.com/538. The numbers, not the letters. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Hims. 66% of men start to lose their hair by age 35, and once you've noticed thinning hair, it can be too late. The best way to prevent more hair loss is to do something about it while you still have some. 4hims.com is a one-stop shop for hair loss, skincare, and other wellness supplements for men. No snake oil pills or gas station counter supplements, just prescription solutions backed by science. Answer a few quick questions, a doctor will review, and if they determine it's right for you, can prescribe you medication to treat hair loss that is shipped directly to your door. Listeners can get started with the Hims Complete Hair Kit for just $5 today, right now, while supplies last, and subject to doctor's approval. See website for full details and safety information. This could cost hundreds if you went to the doctor or a pharmacy somewhere else. Go to 4hims.com/538. That's FORHIMS.com/538. 4hims.com/538. All right, we're back. This was the first debate that Bernie Sanders attended, the first debate since his heart attack, and faced direct questions about his age as a result. How did he answer those?
Well, there's how he answered them implicitly and how he answered them explicitly.
Did he look lively?
I thought Bernie looked good.
He looked virile.
I thought he had a good debate, a really good debate. I think it was Bernie's strongest of the four debates so far. It was one of the better distillations of Bernie we've seen, including in any of the 2016 debates. And he definitely felt well calibrated as far as picking the right levels of aggression, and he can definitely increase the volume on his voice a little bit. And I thought that was mostly fine. I think toward the end it did kind of feel a little bit more like Bernie talking about billionaires. I do think that there are some times when Warren seems more empathetic. I thought the way kind of she answered the question about, hey, basically, do you want to be punitive to billionaires? And he's like, well, yeah, kind of. And she's like, no, we just want to pay their fair share because it takes a village. I do think that's more effective in the long run. But I thought he did quite well for himself. I happen to not think that one of his stronger moments was the literal question about age. He kind of ducked it by saying, well, we're going to have a big rally in Queens, which now turns out is going to be rollout of AOC and perhaps other endorsements. You know, voters are concerned about the age and health of Bernie and Biden, and more so on Bernie after the heart attack. And the media seems reluctant to press for follow-ups and stuff like that. And I don't think he really kind of addressed that directly to voters who might actually be concerned about it. But I don't know. I also am not sure what he's supposed to say. And here's kind of where my my bias shines through, because I'd be in favor of a constitutional amendment saying that you should not be able to run for another term for president or first term if you're over the age of 75, just like you can't if you're under 35. And so that's my bias.
Taking away Americans' freedoms.
Well, but Nate, I had the same reaction to you that I thought his explicit answer on health and age, it wasn't bad, but it just wasn't very, very memorable. But I tend to think, and this goes back to what we were talking about last week, that it's actually the implicit stuff, just how he looked on stage, how he sounded on stage, that matters more. And I would not be surprised at all if, you know, those polls that ask how concerned are you about so-and-so's age or health, if we start to see Bernie's numbers sort of revert back to where Biden is. In other words, if you start to see that heart attack bounce fade a bit.
As a reminder, it was 43% of Democratic voters said they thought Bernie Sanders was too old. It was 28% Biden and 4% Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah, and 28, if it's 28% for Bernie rather than 43%, that's a big improvement. It maybe is still a problem, but but I think his numbers will improve on that front.
And the way Biden addressed it was he said that he was going to put out a bunch of information about his health. I don't know if that's meaningful to people, but allowed him to contrast himself with Trump. Claire, what did you make of how that interaction went down and kind of how Bernie's... I think there were questions going into this debate of, like, is he... How did we describe it? Valedictory. What's the answer? How did that all play out?
Oh, I don't really think I ever had any question about how Bernie Sanders would act on a debate stage, which is just how he did, right? Which is like, I'm still here. I want to win this. I was going to ask who the closest analog in electoral history is to Sanders's election time heart attack. Would it be Dick Cheney?
Bill Bradley had some heart condition in 2000.
I don't think you compare. I mean, Dick Cheney is probably literally the closest, but I don't think VP, I don't think you can compare.
George H.W. Bush had questions about his health when he was running for his second term in 1992. You probably remember there was the like passing out / vomiting in Japan.
Yeah.
I guess it's like, you know, it's this funny thing where, I mean, I think it makes voters uncomfortable, especially if they're Sanders supporters, because it makes you, just address the idea of mortality in general. You know, that this person that you like and admire could be dead or incapacitated in the span of 4 to 8 years is sort of a dark thought. So maybe this is getting like, I don't know what it is, but like maybe he gets a bounce back because people have some, his supporters will kind of say like, yeah, he seemed fine. And right, you don't want to address the idea that like, well, he had a heart attack. Small or sort of, you know, a stent procedure is very regular, but very typical for a person his age. I just find it to be sort of this really odd mixture of Sanders has a very particular kind of base that kind of would love the comeback from a heart attack underdog story.
No, I think that, Claire, I think that extends beyond his base. Like, actually, I think it makes him sympathetic, right? You kind of want to root for someone who has overcome a health problem. It also, frankly, though, just like, to be really crass about it, puts like a fresh spin on a candidate who has been essentially running the same campaign for like 5-6 years, right?
Okay. Are you sure it's good news for Bernie Sanders when the media narrative is he had a heart attack, but now he seems fine?
No. But
it's a little bit like how the Hillary Clinton
sure.
folks.
That's the whole point.
Yeah, we're not sure. And I'm totally not sure. I guess I'm just saying that I would not be surprised if both voters are more sympathetic to Sanders' message. He had a good debate. Maybe they're more open to it. But also that the media is more sympathetic to Sanders. So like, if Sanders did have a good debate and we get a couple good polls that show Sanders at, you know, 2 or 3 points up from where he was before, I just wouldn't be surprised. It's like it's a human thing.
I don't think that the media will be sympathetic to Sanders, though. I mean, I think you already saw people writing kind of irritated stories right after the heart incident before we knew it was a heart attack. They didn't let the press talk to his doctors right away. He still hasn't released his updated, you know, medical history. I just have a hard time seeing media in general giving Sanders a pass on this.
Well, I'm just saying, like, it's kind of like when the FBI announced that, oh, actually, Hillary's email server is fine. You know, people still have FBI Clinton email. I wonder about that. And I also think, actually, Sanders was treated relatively gently by the press about the heart attack as compared to like what would have happened to Biden.
No, yeah.
But like, yeah, with all that said, people love a comeback story. Look, I think between tonight and the rally, and maybe most importantly, the three of these endorsements that he got, he's clearly sending a message like, don't give up on me, which is worth something. So maybe a few of the people who migrated away from Sanders to Warren or to Yang or something in the past couple of weeks will come back. Maybe he'll fend off kind of further downward movement. I still think the kind of fundamental critique of Sanders applies, which is that, like, I still think he hasn't quite figured out how to appeal beyond this kind of core 15%, which is not just like left, but also anti-establishment left. And the squad endorsements are on brand. They're not stretching into a new type of endorser that you might not have expected. Actually, one other question I have is, like, will Warren now say trusted kind of mainstream members of the left, right? Will they come out? Because she has not had that many endorsements either.
Well, so that's the thing is, like, you brought up the idea earlier, Nate, of Warren getting squeezed. And something Perry Bacon, one of our writers, and I have been talking about is the fact that if you look at our endorsement tracker, Warren, for someone who has been steadily climbing in the polls, has picked up a surprisingly few number of endorsements, like very, very few. And so I maybe they're just biding their time. I do wonder a little bit if Warren is not quite so acceptable to the establishment as maybe some of us thought, just because we were comparing her to Sanders.
But to pick some names at random, like, I wonder if, like, a Tammy Baldwin is a senator in Wisconsin, or Patty Murray in Washington, right? Some of the more liberal female members. I do wonder if there'll be a little bit more pressure on her. And again, we are kind of believers that endorsements matter, although it's kind of weird because usually the endorsements are like the sign of what the establishment is doing. So I'm not quite sure how we're supposed to kind of, in our party decides configuration, kind of think about, like, how does an anti-establishment endorsement figure in? You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, and we also just don't know, like, to what extent the endorsements are signal versus cause or whatever.
Yeah.
You know.
It could just tell us that it's, I mean, so far what it's told us is that the party is splintered and not making a decision.
Yeah, totally. That's the main thing. They have not made a decision.
All right, so it's getting late here, but let's spend our final moments on the candidates who were not in the top three. So, first of all, broad question. Our former colleague and friend Harry Enten crunched some numbers before this debate and said something along the lines of, looking at history since 1972, there's a 15% chance approximately that the person who goes on to win the Democratic nomination is not Biden, Warren, or Sanders.
That seems about right.
Does that seem about right? So if there's that 15% chance, who is it? Did we learn anything from tonight's debate about who that could be?
So if it's not Biden, Warren, or Sanders, I would pick Mayor Pete because he can win Iowa.
All right. I guess, did the debate inform anything about Buttigieg's shot?
It obviously, in my book, was sort of a new phase for Buttigieg. It was kind of like, almost like Mean Pete appeared on stage, right? A little bit more no holds barred. And I think you can almost directly chalk that up to the Iowa focus that his campaign has. He sees Warren as his biggest threat. And in some ways, he's trying to crowd Biden out of his moderate lane. And that's a pretty good tactic because Biden's campaign is on the record as saying, oh, we don't have to win Iowa or even New Hampshire necessarily. We're going to start winning in, you know, let's say South Carolina. Buttigieg's team might be seeing that and saying, fine, let's take all of Biden's voters in Iowa and paint Elizabeth Warren as too far left to get elected with Midwestern Democrats, and let's go to town. To me, I mean, that it was in some ways like a demarcation for me of how of a different mode that Buttigieg can be in. I think he was much more aggressive and much less, you know, nice new kid on the block, right? It was almost kind of him saying, take me seriously, my poll numbers beg you to do so, and I'm willing to play hardball and not be deferential to these two, you know, big, well-known people in the party.
He also kind of got moved, I think, because he has now, like, overtaken Harris in the polls, or just the way it was set up, right? Yeah. He was actually, like, often the frame of the shot of the top four candidates out of 12, because it's an even number. So I guess he actually did, like, take advantage of that small advantage he has over Harris in recent polls, and, like, kind of literally looks like he's more centered. He's been pretty good in these debates. He has a fair amount of money. He has a plausible path in Iowa. I don't know if he can consolidate enough of the party to win after Iowa. I don't know how he would withstand a period where he faced a lot of scrutiny about his experience, right? It is like, you know, it's late at night, so it's kind of Nate, like, telling it like it is. I do think, like,
it's Nate on Red Bull telling it like
Nate,
it is.
Yeah, Nate after hours.
I do think in the long run, like, hey, we're mayor of a medium to small sized town in Indiana, and now you want to be president of the United States. I do think there's, like, a round of scrutiny, but you can imagine, like, Buttigieg peaking at the right time. And so if you're giving me like, if you're giving me 15% to spend I'd spend six of that on Buttigieg or something.
Oh, I might spend more than that. I mean, he is in double digits an average of Iowa polls, basically in double digits in an average of New Hampshire polls. I mean, he's doing way better there than anywhere else. Most of his support is white. But Harris didn't have a great night on Tuesday night. So, like, maybe Buttigieg solidifies his place as the fourth candidate. I do think Claire's right that it'll be really interesting to watch. It did feel like this was a different strategy by Buttigieg tonight. Does that play well? Does that play poorly? I have no idea.
I mean, Harris, like, what's she got now? Like 4%? What is she at in RCP? I don't know, man. I know 4% isn't a lot. But if I were Warren or Buttigieg or Biden or anyone, she's at 5.2% in RCP. I'd be looking at that 5.2% and saying, can I pick off a point or two of that?
Yeah.
Because she was not very present in the debate. I thought her answer on impeachment actually at the start was really good. And maybe they could have gone longer on like kind of probing the candidates more on what their impeachment strategy would have been and stuff like that, right? Instead of asking about Ellen and George W. Bush at the end. And not asking, by the way, about China and Daryl Morey
or climate change.
Seems like China and climate change might be two really interesting things to ask about.
All right, as we wrap up here, any other people of note to allot that 15% to, Claire?
The short, uncharitable answer is no.
Yeah.
Not really. God bless Tom Steyer. He got on stage and wore a fun tie. But I don't think 12 people deserve to be on that stage. You know, like, I think it is at that point where maybe 6 or 7, but certainly not 12. And I think that a lot of those people kind of bore it out. Maybe Klobuchar made some valiant efforts to sort of, she spoke a ton. She kind of made a valiant effort to be the spunky Midwestern moderate, but I just have a hard time seeing the validity of so many people being up there.
Yeah. And we may, to Claire's point, start to see some winnowing soon. Some of the fundraising numbers also show people, I mean, Julian Castro, did he do anything in this debate?
Yeah, so there were four people on that stage who have not yet made the November debate, and that's Julian Castro, Amy Klobuchar, Tulsi Gabbard, and Beto O'Rourke.
Yeah.
So I don't know if any of those four people made their case for why they should be on the stage in November.
No, and also some of the fundraising numbers coming in don't look great for some of those people and show them kind of spending more than they're taking in. So I think Claire's right that the next debate and certainly the one after that, I think maybe we'll start to see smaller and smaller field.
All right. Well, let's leave things there. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, guys.
And thanks, Micah.
Thank you.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.